Today is Monday, May 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the battle against Hamas continues full force. This after strikes bombed the home of Hamas's chief in Gaza early Sunday.
Israel has recorded 10 deaths, while health officials in Gaza have reported at least 148 people killed since the violence began last week.
And we take a look back at the iconic career of VOA broadcaster Willis Conover. These stories and more next. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Sunday that he's not planning any immediate end to the deadly airstrikes on Gaza, hours after his military's jet fighters flattened three buildings and killed at least 42 people. Netanyahu said that the battle would continue full force against Hamas, the ruling party, and Gaza's government, and that they were inflicting a heavy price. The prime minister said that the Israeli Defense Forces carried out attacks on more than 1,500 targets in the past week. Netanyahu signaled on Sunday that the fighting between Israeli and Palestinians in Gaza would continue despite international efforts to broker a ceasefire. Israel bombed the home of Hamas's chief in Gaza early on Sunday, and the Islamist group fired rocket barrages at Tel Aviv as hostilities stretched into a seventh day. Reuters' Brian Wood is up first.
The sounds of heavy bombardment across the coastal enclave roared through the night. According to Hamas television, Yahya al-Sinwari's home was targeted. He's led the military and political wings of Hamas in Gaza since 2017. Meanwhile, Israelis in Tel Aviv and Beersheba dashed for bomb shelters as sirens blared, warning of incoming rocket fire. Israel has recorded 10 deaths, while health officials in Gaza have reported at least 148 people killed since the violence began last week. Both Israel and Hamas have insisted they would continue their cross-border fire, a day after Israel destroyed a 12-story media building in Gaza City, which housed an Associated Press and Al Jazeera bureau.
Brian Wood reports for Reuters News. The latest outbreak of fighting began last Monday after conflicts in East Jerusalem last month. Palestinian clashes with police erupted in response to Israeli police tactics during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan and Jewish settlers threatening to evict dozens of Palestinian families. A focal point of the unrest was the Al-Aqsa Mosque, located on a hilltop compound that is revered by both Muslims and Jews. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Sunday for an immediate ceasefire among Israelis and Palestinians. And earlier today, I spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir following a special Sunday Security Council meeting about the ongoing violence.
So it's one of these rare Sunday meetings. They haven't had one since 2016. And the council is all online these days because of COVID. So it wasn't in the big chamber. So it kind of lacked that authority that kind of comes with the setting. But it was chaired by the Chinese foreign minister. China is the council president this month. And China, along with Norway and Tunisia, called for this emergency meeting as the violence continues to spiral. And their foreign ministers also spoke at the meeting. The Russian deputy foreign minister spoke. And then as interested parties, basically Jordan and Egypt, spoke at the meeting, their foreign ministers. And basically, everybody is trying to call for calm, but the two parties, Israel and the Palestinians, are kind of still pointing fingers at each other. And so really, nothing was accomplished. We know everybody's positions. Their positions haven't changed, including the 15 members of the UN Security Council. But it was an exercise to say we are paying attention and we are very, very concerned that this is going to spiral out of control. But the bottom line is really there will be no change on the ground because the council met. And this is problematic because the council's credibility is at stake here and they can't seem to control this conflict or really, for that matter, any other.
Did they mention at all what they plan to do? Because as you mentioned when we last spoke, there are permanent members of the Security Council who can veto measures moving forward. But, you know, this meeting didn't come up with any results.
True. true. I mean, there were really there was no outcome. We learned that the UN, Egypt, and Qatar are trying to broker this ceasefire that's going on. President Biden of the United States spoke yesterday with both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. One of the big things that was repeatedly brought up at this meeting, and I think it's important to talk about this time around, because unfortunately we've seen many rounds of violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians over the years, children are really suffering. And UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, said on Sunday that 55 children in Palestine have been killed so far in Israeli airstrikes, and 2 children in Israel. And I believe in that count, they're counting 1 girl who's 16, who's an Arab Israeli. So, I mean, the children are really, you know, there's just been such a high number of child casualties in this violence. And international calls are really focused on that, trying to get to bring the parties to their senses. And, all the members of the Security Council condemned the violence on both sides, told them, you know, Israel, you have a right to defend yourself, but you must do it proportionately and in line with international humanitarian law. But to Hamas, they said you must stop the indiscriminate rocket attacks. So both sides are, you know, have blame here. On Tuesday, the European Union foreign ministers will meet. In the meantime, the UN Secretary General is trying to resurrect the long dormant quartet on Middle East peace to try and get them to have a foreign minister level meeting. So there's a lot of diplomacy going on, but whether it will stop anything, I don't know, because the Israeli ambassador said, we've made our decision. We're here to stop Hamas.
VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Sunday marked Eid al-Fitr and the conclusion of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. However, in place of a White House iftar, which is the meal marking the end of the religious holiday, U.S. President Joe Biden and his wife released a video message to the Muslim community for the occasion. But several prominent Muslim groups have said that they would not attend the virtual event due to what some groups were calling the Biden administration's insufficient response to the ongoing violence between Israel and Gaza. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Witakaswara shared those details with me.
So the Council on American Islamic Relations of CARE is the U.S. largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization. So it's kind of like an umbrella network of Muslim organizations around the country. And they're essentially saying that they're boycotting because they are disappointed and disturbed by the Biden administration's response to what they see as the Israeli government's human rights abuses against Palestinians in Gaza and East Jerusalem. So the White House virtual Eid celebration was online on Sunday afternoon, evening. But yeah, this is basically what the Muslim organizations in the U.S. is doing. It's really just putting pressure, a lot of pressure, on the Biden administration to do more in what they see is a pretty hands-off approach to the conflict in the in between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And they feel that the Biden administration should be doing more, not just, you know, condemning the violence and urging for calm, but actually trying to put more resources politically and in terms of just like sending people and sending help and so on to de-escalate the situation quicker than what is happening on the ground right now.
What has the Biden administration said it is doing to end the violence? Because over the weekend, President Biden did have phone calls with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the Palestinian Authority Mahmoud Abbas.
Yeah, so there's definitely some high-level communication going on. You've mentioned, you know, the leaders communicating in person. The White House has also sent, the State Department has sent envoys to the region, not just to meet with the Palestinians and the Israelis, but also other stakeholders in the region. So that is being done. But in essence, I think what is being seen coming from the Biden administration is a reaction that is too little and too late, because before this violence, it seems very clear that they did not prioritize the issue of Israelis and Palestinians. And in fact, the whole Middle East as a region was not a foreign policy priority for the Biden administration, who wanted to focus on, of course, domestic challenges with the pandemic and economic recovery, how to deal with the strategic competition with China as well as Russia. So they really wanted to avoid this whole Middle East conflict. But of course, as past presidents before President Joe Biden have tried, they've not been able to just extract themselves from the Middle East, and they always just get sucked back into the Middle East conflict situation, the same way that President Barack Obama wanted to pivot to Asia, but then got sucked back to the Middle East as well.
Now, speaking about the Eid celebration that was scheduled for Sunday, has the White House made any public comments about the criticism it is receiving from Muslim American groups?
I have asked. I have reached out to Jen Psaki. So far, it's been a couple of hours, and there has been no response or no immediate response from the White House. And it's actually quite clear that the White House has been trying to downplay this event, because I have been hunting them down for the past couple of days. First of all, just to confirm that the event is happening, and only until Friday late afternoon, very, you know, understated statement on the White House website saying from the president saying that the First Lady and the president are looking forward to the White House commemoration of Eid. They are heartened to see Eid celebrations around the world, but understand that the situation in the Holy Land is weighing heavily on Muslims everywhere, including our Muslim communities here in the United States. So the White House understands extremely well that this is a sensitive issue, and they're trying to manage it in a way that does not offend even further Muslim organizations, American Muslims, but also American Israelis, and, you know, obviously the pro-Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. So this is a sensitive situation for them, and they're trying to figure out a way to handle it as best as they can. So despite the boycott of some major American Muslim organizations, there are still some American Muslims participating in the virtual Eid event. You know, this is open to the public. Anyone can access the link, and American Muslim organizations have been sending out the link before they boycotted this event. So this event is quite well known. I'd like to add that this virtual White House Eid celebration is a continuation of a tradition that goes back to all the way to Bill Clinton, who started the first White House iftar tradition that was followed by all his successors, except for President Trump, I believe, in 2017.
Patsy Wiedekaswara is VOA's White House correspondent. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. On May 12th, the U.S. Department of State provided Congress with its annual Religious Freedoms Report. That's a report that describes the state of religious freedoms in every nation. And as usual, it found that the government's and non-state persecution of religious groups continues in many parts of the world, including Africa. The report also noted that there had been some improvement in some nations as well. And to get a sense of the state of affairs, both worldwide and on the African continent itself, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dan Nadell, the senior official for religious freedom at the U.S. State Department. Mr. Nadell began by explaining why it is in America's interest to promote religious freedom throughout the world.
We believe that religious freedom is a key feature in healthy societies. And when people are not able to organize their lives in accordance with their most central beliefs, the main themes that they care about in their lives, they're not going to be satisfied across the board. And it's more likely that you might disengage from society. You might turn to violence. So as part of our national security, we see it as really important that societies be healthy. And one of these features of health is respect for religious freedom.
Your office has just released its report on the overall state of religious freedoms in the world. In very broad strokes, what does it say?
Sure. So the overall state of religious freedom in the world is that there are a lot of challenges. More than 80% of people around the world live in countries with high or severe restrictions on the practice and exercise of religion. In Africa in particular, you have Eritrea. The government only recognizes four religious groups and harasses and jails those who practice non-sanctioned religions. The Orthodox patriarch Antonios has been under house arrest since 2006, and members of all religious groups there were to varying degrees subjected to government abuses or restrictions, including Jehovah's Witnesses. We acknowledge that the government has released a number of religious prisoners over the past year, but we understand that many more remain imprisoned, and so we would strongly encourage the government to take steps to ensure that all religious prisoners are being released.
I know that historically, Nigeria has often been a hotspot for these sort of issues.
In Nigeria, what we've seen is continued lack of accountability for the military's killing of 350 people, mostly Shia Muslims, in Zaria in 2005. And the head of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, the largest Shia organization in the country, El-Zaksi, and his wife remain imprisoned despite a 2016 court ruling that they be released. And we also see state-level authorities arresting and detaining people for blasphemy. So those are significant challenges. The head of the Humanist Association of Nigeria has been imprisoned without charges since April of 2020. And then also in Nigeria, we see violence between predominantly Muslim Fulani herdsmen and predominantly Christian farmers in the Middle Belt. And we're encouraging the government to address the root causes of that violence to ensure that it does not spin further out of control.
What about non-mainstream indigenous religions and spiritual practices?
Yes, unfortunately, it is the case in Africa, in Latin America, in East Asia, where you have large indigenous communities that members of majority communities and others often marginalize them. And other human rights issues related to these indigenous communities include property rights, access to education and health care. So this is certainly something that's on our radar. And what we try to do is we try to build and maintain relationships with indigenous communities to understand their concerns, their needs, to help empower them to articulate those needs with their governments.
What methods do you bring to bear, diplomatic, military, otherwise, to promote religious freedoms among groups or governments who would violate them?
Yeah, thank you for that question. What we try to do here in the International Religious Freedom Office is to work with partners, both internal, the government, but also external, foreign governments, civil society groups, religious communities themselves, to promote positive discourse. And so we're obviously using all of the tools in the diplomatic toolbox, both positive and punitive, if it involves holding an abuser accountable, that could involve sanction or other penalties, but also positives, embracing diversity in public ways and giving credit to governments that have taken creative steps to enhance tolerance and mutual respect within their society. We work a lot with international partners as well. So the hope is that we create a critical mass of voices for mutual respect, for tolerance, for non-discrimination. And those voices can ultimately drown out those who would seek to discriminate or abuse or harass on the basis of religion.
That was U.S. State Department's Senior Official for Religious Freedom, Dan Nadell, speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips. Uganda's refugee population has reported no cases of COVID-19. In the Bidibidi settlement, located in the Yumbi district, the refugee leaders there are working tirelessly to maintain that status quo. Halina Athumani takes it from here.
In Bangatuti village, Bidibidi settlement, four Refugee Welfare Council members meet to discuss the awareness message to the community. When COVID-19 broke out in Uganda in March 2020, the Ugandan government quickly shut its door to new refugees, including those from South Sudan, to curb the spread of the disease caused by the coronavirus. According to the Johns Hopkins University, Uganda currently has more than 42,600 confirmed infections and 347 deaths. Data Kenyi, a Refugee Welfare Council member, says since then, the refugees have been closely monitored.
Tell them to observe the social distancing, hand washing. Them say just the SOPs put in place. There's no high rate infection in the settlement. Whoever came new has to go for 14 days quarantine. From there, then we join the community and be safe.
In the Ugandan refugee settlements, the markets, schools, and health centers that are in zones closer to the local community are open to both refugees and locals. This can be a catalyst for the spread of COVID-19 if the refugees are not checked. Uganda has prioritized frontline health workers for the vaccine that is being administered around the country. At Abirimajio Market, which is open to refugees, Neva Rukia says she has heard on radio about people getting vaccinated and is wondering when they will be considered. She says they say that if you have not attained the age of 50, you won't get vaccinated. She also says, I'm 32 years and they say I don't qualify for the vaccination. Am I not at risk of being infected? On Sunday, under grass thatched mud and water church, more than 100 members of a Protestant church congregation sat attentively listening to the priest. Many of them were women and children, some with masks and others without. Esther Luma, the church lay reader, explains the challenges facing the community. The church leader is a refugee, and the congregation consists of all refugees.
We don't have money for buying this sanitizer and the masks. Yeah, because the church is having no budget. Even the facility for washing hands is also difficult for us to get.
Uganda is home to 1.4 million refugees. UN partners such as the UN High Commissioner for Refugees say they will continue to urge Uganda to reopen its borders, but this may not happen until the East African country builds adequate capacity to test and quarantine new variants of the coronavirus. Halima Athmani for VA News, Yumbe District, Northern Uganda.
Chileans were urged on Sunday to follow through on their call for a new constitution as voting to pick the architects of the charter entered a second day. The vote comes amid concerns about low turnout, particularly in the country's more marginalized areas. Observers around the South American nation reported a slow start in most of the polling stations. 14 million people are eligible to pick the 155 individuals who will draft the new constitution, and the government is hoping for a turnout of about 7 million. Those chosen will spend a maximum of 12 months crafting the new text, with a two-thirds majority required for each key decision, forcing delegates to form alliances. Fighters of a local militia opposed to Myanmar's junta have pulled back from the northwestern town of Mindat after days of assault by combat troops backed by artillery. That's according to a member of the group speaking to Reuters News on Sunday. The United States and Britain called on the army to avoid civilian casualties and a shadow national unity government formed by loyalists of Myanmar's detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi appealed for international help. A spokesman for the junta did not answer calls for comment. The U.S.-funded Radio Free Asia website also quoted a member of the group as saying five of its fighters were killed, but that it believed that the group had inflicted losses several times that many on the army.
This is Science in a Minute.
Recently discovered fossilized tracks suggest that large mammals from about 58 million years ago enjoyed going to the ocean as much as we humans do today. The findings suggest that this first evidence of mammals visiting a seaside environment took place about 9.4 million years earlier than thought. University of Utah geologist Anton Roblewski found the tracks of the brown bear-sized Coryphodon at the Hanna Formation of Wyoming. He and Bonnie Gulis Roblewski from Texas A&M had a study on the new discovery published in the journal Scientific Reports. Keep in mind that while the ocean today is hundreds of kilometers away from the discovery site, Wyoming was considered to be a beachfront property back when these creatures walked the earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN agencies are urging policymakers to lower speed limits in a bid to cut traffic deaths and injuries. A campaign to get people to slow down on the roads will be launched on Monday at the start of the United Nations Global Road Safety Week. Lisa Schlein has those details.
Every year, more than 1.3 million people die in road traffic crashes and 50 million are injured. One person dies every 24 seconds because of a crash. The United Nations says car crash injuries are the eighth leading cause of death globally for all age groups. It is also the leading cause of death among children and young adults between the ages of 5 and 29. The focus of this year's Global Road Safety Week is to encourage policymakers to drop speed limits to 30 kilometers an hour in cities where cyclists and pedestrians interact closely with car traffic. The head of security and mobility at the World Health Organization, Nan Tran, says reducing the speed limit to 30 kilometers per hour in city streets will save lives.
Most people, most cyclists, pedestrians will survive if they're hit by a car traveling at 30 kilometers per hour or 20 miles per hour. Beyond that speed limit, the risk of death becomes much higher. And that's why we consider 30 kilometers per hour or 20 miles per hour a safe speed, because it means that most people will survive.
Slower speed, he says, has other benefits in making cities more livable. Tran notes cars are a big source of carbon dioxide emissions. He says slower speed will result in a significant drop in emissions, which will improve air quality. Since early last year, he says COVID-19 lockdowns and an increase in the number of people working from home has led to a marked decrease in the number of people driving. However, he adds this has not resulted in fewer traffic deaths.
In fact, although we have observed a reduction in the amount of traffic and, in fact, in the amount of crashes, what we have seen is that there has been an increase in severity of crashes because the roads have been empty due to confinement and lockdown, and people have taken that as an opportunity to actually speed, and they're taking this opportunity to drive faster, and therefore you're seeing more fatal crashes.
The WHO reports Africa is the region with the highest number of road traffic fatalities in the world, with a rate of about 26 per 100,000 population. This against 10 fatalities per 100,000 in the Europe region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, Monday, May 17th marks the 25th anniversary of the death of Willis Conover. He's a Voice of America broadcaster who helped popularize American jazz worldwide. Michael Sullivan takes this look back at his career and global impact on music as well as diplomacy.
Willis Conover speaking. This is the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
Between 1955 and 1996, Conover had one of the world's most familiar and distinctive voices as tens of millions tuned in for his weekly Jazz Hour. Through the dark days of the Cold War, the U.S. government embraced jazz as a way to promote American values, and Conover helped create worldwide interest in the music.
He believed that jazz was an art form for everyone, but he also saw it as being something that was democratic, something where the strength came from a willingness to listen, a willingness to improvise, and he found those same qualities in the democratic system in the United States.
He was close to the greats of the jazz world, musicians like Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Sarah Vaughan. Black musicians were immensely popular, but faced widespread prejudice.
He broke those barriers, especially in Washington, D.C., by producing concerts intentionally, blending people with different ethnic backgrounds into groups to perform in the clubs in D.C.
Conover built bridges, whether touring Eastern Europe or broadcasting from his studio.
Let's hear another example of jazz from Hungary.
He once did a special program just for jazz fans in India. U.S. officials sponsored overseas tours by jazz musicians, and Conover, an international star, sometimes accompanied them. He introduced musicians to new styles and audiences to talents like South Africa's Miriam Makeba.
It's always been a music that interacted with adjacent styles. So it's just evolving with as it continues to interact with what's out there.
Conover promoted this cross-pollination and left a major legacy in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe.
People talk about him in Cuba. He's well remembered in Russia. And I think it's a part of his fate is to be forgotten in his own country, but still beloved internationally.
Conover also left his mark on generations of musicians in all parts of the world. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Of jazz parallels the freedom.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.